a great beginning for chapter two of what Foreigner is and should be. And I honestly think we have yet to reach the kind of complete album that Foreigner 4 was. Again, I think we have to strive for something different, but as good. It's to me, it is the high point of Foreigner. Yeah,
hi, I'm Lou Graham.
Hi, this is Mick Jones of Foreigner in the studio for Foreigner 4.
In the late 1970s, the band Foreigner seemed destined to become a classic case of too much too soon. The band's first, 1977's Foreigner, and Double Vision in 1978, were multi-platinum hits of unprecedented proportions. For instance, Double Vision has sold 7 million copies. Foreigner entered the rock and roll arena as a full-blown star. It was heady stuff, to be sure, but that kind of rapid success is often a recipe for quick decline as well. For Foreigner, the critical point came after their third album, Head Games, was released in 1979. It didn't do as well as the first two albums, and band members started to blame each other. The result was the departure of two of Foreigner's original members, Ian MacDonald and Al Greenwood. There were serious questions about whether the remaining four should even continue as a band. In the end, lead guitar player, founder, songwriter Mick Jones, lead singer Lou Graham, bass player Rick Wills, and drummer Dennis Elliott decided to forge ahead. The result was their most successful album ever, the album of the year in 1981. It was number one on the American charts for 10 consecutive weeks, and its name, simple but significant, was Foreigner 4. Mick Jones, Foreigner's lead guitarist and founder, reflects on the crises and triumphs that marked the beginnings of this album, Foreigner 4.
No, we'd started to rehearse for the 4 album. I was so frustrated because I felt that the direction of the band was getting so diverse, with everybody wanting to express themselves. You know, the time, I guess, well, you know, it's a natural evolution. The time had come when I wasn't hogging the writing. I was ready to be challenged by anybody else's ideas. And as far as I was concerned, what the object was to achieve was achieving a great album, you know, the best that we could do, the best that we could come up with. And I was pretty strong-minded about it. And, you know, I knew that certain things were going to dilute the direction of the band as in what still was to me a formative stage of the band. You know, we still hadn't to that point proved ourselves particularly, you know, although I must say the euphoria added to the confusion of the Head Games era. You know, we did get a bit carried away. If I'd say that we did get carried away, we were all a bit, you know, we were carried away, I guess, a little bit at that point, all believing in ourselves a bit. And I certainly was, you know. I thought I was pretty smart at that point after what we'd achieved, you know. And it went to my head, I guess. You know, it went to everybody's head to a certain extent. But luckily, we were able to come back from that and get down to the meaning of things, I think.
We'll be right back.
The recording sessions for the Foreigner 4 album began in the late summer of 1980 at Electric Lady Studios in New York City, as lead singer Lou Gramm recalls.
After we toured Japan as the last leg of the Head Games tour, the whole touring of that album was it was an uphill struggle, I think, and we just had to kind of reflect on what we wanted to do with our careers following this. And I secretly was of the mind that if it couldn't be a little more fulfilling for me, that I would rather move on. And Mick, as I learned later, had similar feelings. And at that point, we weren't tossing around personnel changes. We actually began to write and rehearse for Foreigner 4 with the six-piece band intact. And it was only after a week in the studio that the kind of undercurrent and dissatisfaction came to a head. And I think the changes were made, or I think the band would have fallen apart right in the studio.
I want you to tell me where I'm.
by Mick Jones and sung by Lou Gramm. That's the portentous Break It Up from Foreigner and Foreigner 4. Mick Jones was a veteran of the English blues rock band Spooky Tooth, and even though he had founded Foreigner, and in spite of the fact that their third album, Head Games, did sell past the million mark, Mick knew the warning signs all too well.
Well, I saw the band disintegrating, you know, as a band, and I thought, and I had to sort of take stock of things, and I was the one to sort of bring it to a point, you know, to bring it out, but I sat with Lou one night, I think we were in Japan at the end of a tour around the Head Games time, and I said, look, this is just falling apart, you know, this, you know, I mean, I was almost ready to leave at that point. I was getting a bit, disillusion was rearing its head at that point with me.
Keep my head above the water.
That's I'm Gonna Win from the album Foreigner 4. From Foreigner 4, that song has kicked out the jams in many a car stereo just after sundown since July 1981, written by Mick Jones and Lou Gramm. Up next, they share the true story behind the magical song Waiting for a Girl Like You. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for the anniversary of Foreigner 4.
Hi, I'm Lou Gramm.
Hi, this is Mick Jones of Foreigner in the studio for Foreigner 4.
And I'm Redbeard. So band leader Mick Jones took the drastic action of firing original Foreigner members Ian McDonald and Al Greenwood while in the studio, pairing the group back to four members. The revised Foreigner lineup left Mick Jones with mixed feelings.
I kind of sort of looked at it coldly, and I realized that there was a core of the band, as far as I could feel, and it was between myself and Lou and Dennis. You know, that was the core that had survived from the beginning. And Rick came along with that at that point too. And that's how we, through many deliberations and painful times, we decided to take the band down to four people. That was probably the toughest part of the whole thing.
In the beginning, Foreigner had been a product of Brit Mick Jones' vision, but it didn't take long for upstate New Yorker Lou Gramm to emerge as an equally important creative force.
It felt more like a group as a four-piece band than it ever did as a six. And I don't mean it to be cold, because there was camaraderie. We had been through a lot as a six-piece band, and it was, on one hand, it hurt because it was tearing a piece of the band away. On the other hand, it was so much more fulfilling, and as a career move, it was the right thing to do.
Come down, you wanna live.
That's the number four charting hit from the summer of 1981, Urgent from Foreigner 4, with its wild, distinctive sax solo from Motown legend Junior Walker. Junior Walker just happened to be playing a club date in Manhattan at a club called the Lone Star at that time. Foreigner was recording their fourth album in New York City, so Mick Jones impulsively invited Junior Walker to record the solo. Foreigner lead singer Lou Gramm remembers how it went down.
He made it down to the Lone Star and coerced Junior into coming to play on this song. Junior had never heard of Foreigner, never heard of the band, didn't think one way or the other about the song. So he tuned up and he made one pass at the solo and said, well, that's it. I'll be seeing you. But, I mean, it took Mick and Mutt and all their combined charm to get Junior to make two or three more passes. And between those two or three passes, there was the goods there.
A key factor in the sound of the album was the man who, along with Mick Jones, co-produced it. His name is Mutt Lange. He would continue to gain fame for his work with The Cars and Def Leppard. But in 1981, the only major band that Mutt Lange had worked with had been AC/DC. I asked Lou Gramm how much he knew about producer Mutt Lange before they started working on Foreigner 4.
I don't remember exactly. I just remember a great deal of anticipation in working with him, and had heard he was a real taskmaster and tireless and really had incredible expectations. I was curious to see how he and Mick would interact, because Mick usually set the tone and the direction of the Foreigner albums. And I was just concerned and a little kind of excited to see them go at it. Little be known to me that I would be caught in the middle of a lot of these confrontations. It was just both guns blazing when we went in there, and we knew what we had to accomplish.
As a producer, Mutt Lange has a well-deserved reputation for pushing artists to the limits of their abilities, demanding their very best. For Mick Jones, who'd always been the dominant figure at Foreigner recording sessions, working with Mutt Lange was a real adjustment.
It wasn't an easy time, you know, at the beginning. In fact, every day was, like, for the first few weeks, was, I've had enough, I'm leaving, you know, it was, you know, I mean, some of the things that came out there were amazing, but then we finally realized that we were both intense people and that we respected each other, and that even if, you know, some of the ideas that we came up with weren't accepted, well then, come back with something else and challenge again, you know, and that was a turning point, I think, for both of us.
With the tension released, a new creativity in the songwriting seemed to flow. On the anniversary of Foreigner 4, I asked both Lou Gramm and Mick Jones if they recognized then that they had their strongest crop of songs to date.
Some of them are pretty natural. I mean, you almost know right away. Some things you got to turn them inside out. I mean, I know a lot of these things. I still have cassettes of the early demos laying around on some of the really big ones, and they don't sound anything like. You wouldn't even recognize them, I'm telling you.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, the song develops from a, you know, the initial idea, then you start throwing it around with everybody, and it's everybody else's input as well that comes in, and, you know, some songs really are, you know, immediate, and you don't really have to mess with them.
You don't want to mess with them.
No. But, you know, for the most part, you know, I think you have to put a bit of work into them and see how they fly, you know.
The biggest single from Foreigner 4 was the song Waiting for a Girl Like You, which holds a dubious spot in pop music history, being number two in the singles charts for 10 weeks. That's the longest stretch any song has ever held at number two without getting to the top. Apparently, Foreigner's manager did not pay off the right independent promoter. It happened to Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall Part 2 a year earlier. Lou Gramm remembers the beginnings of Waiting for a Girl Like You.
As we were rehearsing one day, Mick was checking his piano to see that things were in tune. And I had my Walkman running, of all times. And he started, you know, he checked the octaves on the white keys and just started whacking the black keys to see if things were in tune. And there was this very kind of haunting, dun, 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 which he was just hitting randomly. He hit it once. And I captured it on tape. Two or three days later, when him and I sat down to try and find a chorus for this song, I found this little spot on my tape where he'd been checking the piano tuning and played it for him. And we focused in on those four bars. A chorus was born.
To this day, Mick Jones of Foreigner feels something magical about this song. He remembers there was a young woman in the studio when Lou Gramm did the vocal, and that Lou seemed to be singing it just for her.
Quite a stunning young lady walked into the room just before we did it. I've never heard him sing like that before. We had been singing it, and you know, Lou very often would, when we'd be writing, you know, I'd express certain things the way I would sing the thing, and he would sing it and take my emotion. And somehow that was the first time that I really felt that he was inside, you know, we were one person almost. You know, it was like, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was like, whether the girl in question, or, you know, the fact that there was somebody in there he was singing to, or whether, however it was just another part of that very unexplainable song. You know, to me, it's still a mystery to me, that song.
Camped out for 2.5 months at the number 2 slot in 1981, that's Waiting for a Girl Like You. Next, the making of a jukebox hero. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of Foreigner 4.
Hi, I'm Lou Gramm.
Hi, this is Mick Jones of Foreigner in the studio for Foreigner 4.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Redbeard. This is the anniversary of 1981's album of the year, Foreigner 4. It was released in the summer of 1981. The stripped-down four-piece lineup embarked immediately on a world tour that would include more than 200 concert dates. By August of 81, the album was number one in America. All the doubts from a year before were long gone. Here's Foreigner lead singer Lou Gramm.
We just knew that we were going to kick butt from the time we stepped on stage, and you know, the group being pared down, we did have Mark and Bob Mayo accompanying us on that tour as side musicians. The harmonies were terrific for the first time in a couple of tours, and there was just a real pride that was slightly missing on the Head Games tour. Even the songs from Head Games were reworked and probably sounded better then than they did on the album. The response from the kids, there was just a whole panache of songs between ballads and anthems, and you know, we felt like we had a string of hits to play for the kids, and we were all physically in good shape and just full of energy and ready to be rock stars.
Among the songs on the album is a classic rock and roll fable, the story of every kid who's ever had a guitar and a dream. Mick Jones remembers the genesis of Jukebox Hero.
Well, it was a song that started out initially that Lou had written a sort of a beginning to, and I think it was called Take One Guitar at the time. It went through a tremendous amount of changes, and gradually through, I think one day Lou and Matt and I just jammed in the studio, and we came up with a sort of a complete song. That's when it became Jukebox Hero, which was a title that I'd had in stashed away for a while. From that, the story sort of evolved. Something that hit me one night, we were playing, I think it was Cincinnati we were playing, and it was where they'd had some crowd trouble and people had been, a couple of people had been killed or injured at that Who concert there. I think we played there sort of a couple of months after the event. And I saw a kid backstage, you know, and I was feeling a bit strange about the fact that, you know, people had been killed and, you know, all the things that had gone on in this particular Coliseum that we were playing. And I saw this kid backstage and it was raining. And somehow that's the image I took and sort of pursued that as sort of from that point of that backstage door and a fan that was back there, you know, it was sort of a parody about what we go through and what, you know, is a deep lying, underlying thing in attracts us to want to do what we do.
Standing in the rain with his head hung low, couldn't get a ticket, it was a sold out show. Heard the roar of the crowd, he could picture the scene, put his ear to the wall, then like a distant scream, he heard one guitar.
Jukebox Hero, gotta stop.
That's Jukebox Hero from Foreigner 4.
The lyrical thread of that song is based around the groups that I almost saw when I was growing up, the tickets I couldn't get a hold of to see Zeppelin and Hendrix and The Who. Myself and a crowd of other kids, strangers, who had one thing in common, that they wanted to be there, whether they were inside the building or out. And we used to have our heads pressed against the backstage door, just waiting to get a glimpse and just trying to get as much of that sound and the feeling of what was going on inside that auditorium. It's an intense experience, and I wouldn't have traded it for anything. And to put it into words, to put the theme down, I think it's one that many, many kids identify with, and the dream to be up there themselves.
I walked through that door, I felt
That's Woman in Black, written by Mick Jones. In retrospect, the success of the album Foreigner 4 seems almost inevitable. Producer Mutt Lang seemed to bring out the best in Mick Jones and Lou Gramm, and it didn't hurt to have people like Thomas Dolby and Larry Fast playing synthesizers. Even now, lead singer Lou Gramm is awed by how well things turned out.
I think as a band, we finally approached our capabilities. We reached a kind of a group sound. We showed the versatility to extremes, from things like Jukebox and I'm Gonna Win to Girl on the Moon and Waiting for a Girl Like You. We silenced a lot of doubters. We proved live that we were a band to be reckoned with, not just an also-ran when it comes to touring. And I think it was a great beginning for chapter two of what Foreigner is and should be. To me, it is the high point of Foreigner.
Featuring the slide guitar of Hugh McCracken, that's Girl on the Moon from Foreigner 4. And bringing this story up to date, in summer 1999, Foreigner's Mick Jones and Lou Gramm toured following Lou's recuperation from a benign brain tumor, which was surgically removed. Lou's successful outcome is no doubt from his attitude, exemplified here in his response to me when I called his amazing voice a gift.
I just said it is a gift. It's not mine. You know, I take care of it the best I can. It's from above, you know, and I just do what I can do.
Hi, this is Kelly Hansen with Foreigner in the 21st Century Orchestra and Chorus.
Hi, this is Mick Jones of Foreigner in the studio.
You know, Kelly, the reason why we care enough to be curious about Foreigner in the 21st Century at all is because we've all developed a personal relationship with the songs of Mick Jones. Every single time I hear Feels Like the First Time, or Hot Blooded, or Waiting for a Girl Like You, or Jukebox Hero, or I Want to Know What Love Is, I vividly recall a time and a place and usually a girl. Where were you, Kelly Hansen, when you first heard these songs, and what did they mean to your life?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because that exact comment is something that I talk about during the shows, because I think that's what a lot of classic rock is for a lot of people, is connecting the songs, their companion to the memories of people's lives, and I'm very much aware of that taking place. And
have you had the opportunity to discuss with Mick Jones his philosophy of respecting that very personal relationship that Foreigner fan has with these songs?
Oh yeah, and in fact, for me, and this is just my personal opinion, I think the best way to connect to those memories is to hear the songs, you know, just like you remember hearing them. And like I always did when I was in Hurricane, I always sing the songs like they are on the record, because even I, when I would go to a show, would want to hear songs like I heard them on the record. So that was one of the things that we talked about, because we have a responsibility here. This is not some kind of song stylings of Foreigner songs. This is Foreigner, so... you want to be delivering the goods the way people, you know them and hear them and love them.
As far back as 1981 and Foreigner 4, Mick Jones told me that once he lets these songs go, he can no longer really lay claim to them. They become something else entirely to us out here in the middle distance, which is pretty much sacred in Mick's opinion.
That's true. It's like anything. It's like any piece of art that isn't, I think, speaking to you. It's open to your own interpretation. And sometimes that can be a much greater concept than what is originally perceived for the song. Sometimes can be something very small. But I think that Mick talks about that when he wrote I Want to Know What Love Is, that it was meant to be this one thing, but it became something much bigger for the world, and that's what can happen if you just allow it to go out into the ether and become its own thing.
Kelly, let's talk about that which is left unspoken.
All right.
The fact that a head transplant on a famous rock band has the lowest success rate of anything in pop culture. This side of a new James Bond actor.
Right.
Just ask Michael McDonald,
yeah.
Sammy Hagar,
right.
Arnell Pineda with Journey, Lawrence Gowan with Styx,
right.
Or Ronnie Platt with Kansas.
Right.
Y'all should start a support group and get tax-exempt status.
That would be nice. I'll go for that.
I mean, for 10 years now, this guy, Arnell Pineda of Journey, he's had to live with, why don't you just kill yourself so Steve Perry will rejoin Journey?
Yeah.
Can you relate?
Oh, well, of course. But I also had to have a conversation with myself at the beginning of this 13 years ago for me. The lucky thing is that I had been in the business long enough, and I had success on my own in Hurricane and doing some other projects, and So I already was used to how brutal the world can be to you, with a valid basis or not. So I said to myself, do you know there's going to be people out there who will never accept anyone other than Lou in the band? And I get that, and I understand that. And I said, but this is something that I want to do. I think I can do. It's a challenge, and it's a step forward for me. And I think I could lend integrity and sincerity to this catalog of material. And I had to think about what was important to me first, as opposed to being afraid of what other people were going to say or do or whatever upon me coming into the band. And fortunately, they've been overwhelmingly positive and gracious to me. But you know, that's just, that's part of the thing. But you know, the members started changing in Foreigner on the second album. And
that's true.
There's been a lot of changes in this band.
That's true.
But you know, I think the important thing is that these songs are being delivered in the way that they're supposed to be, and they're delivering the message, the same message as they were, you know, originally.
With sales approaching 7 million in the U.S. alone, Mick Jones is pragmatic that Foreigner's artistic and commercial peak came on the brink of the band breaking up.
Each level you get to, I guess it's like a game, you know, you have to sort of go through some hardship if you want to get, or some struggling and whatever, if you want to get to that next stage, you know. I consider I'm still doing that in a way, you know, and every now and again, you know, you're riding high and suddenly you have to go through that sort of, that hard time again to sort of, it's sort of sent in a way to remind you of what, of where you are, you know. That's sort of a personal way of looking at it, which I sort of look back over the years and think that's sort of the way it's been, you know. And I'm kind of quite prepared for that in the future too.
I knew for sure that one guitar. Tony Bat is on the shadow on a backstage door.
These favorite Foreigner classics and more performed with the 21st Century Symphony and Chorus, recorded live in Switzerland, and now a CD, DVD. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Mick Jones and Kelly Hansen. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.